The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has reconvened. The Honorable Peter C. Kavanaugh presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Call case number 4-24-0593, Aladdin Donald versus Ryan and Nolte MD et al. Counsel for the appellant, if you please state your name for the record.
Lauren Michael Legaretta on behalf of the plaintiff.
Thank you. And for the appellee?
Adam Chaddock on behalf of the defendants' appellees.
Thank you. Mr. Lagaretta, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Here, the trial court accepted a version of facts that was respectfully in the light most favorable to Dr. King, not the patient plaintiff, and ignored documented physician involvement in decisions that directly affected this patient's care. Put simply, the medical records present one set of facts, the doctors another, their shared physician yet another, and the plaintiff a blend of them all. This equivocal or muddied communications bears resemblance to the very fact-intensive appellate cases that I've cited, like Bovara, for instance, where the communication, I think in Bovara, it was, the consulting physician was asking about whether it was possible. The treating physician asked if it was possible. The consulting physician thought it was about feasibility. There was a communication error, and there were two different versions of the facts. Here, Mr. Donnell had extensive and occlusive clots in his legs. He went to a local hospital. That local hospital told him he needed a surgical procedure and sent him by ambulance to a second hospital. That second hospital also told him he needed a procedure and also sent him by ambulance to the third hospital. At that third hospital, Mr. Donnell came under the care of Dr. Nolte, a not yet board certified vascular surgeon, who was not sure whether he's even performed this type of procedure prior to Mr. Donnell's involvement. It's undisputed that Dr. King was on staff and was identified by OSF St. Francis as the consult during Mr. Donnell's admission. And I think I have a citation of the document production on that to the record. It's C 642. Now, when Mr. Donnell came under the care of Dr. Nolte came to him and said, "You can go home. You just need to take a pill." And what is documented in the medical records, which is again what sets this, I think, unique from the cases cited by defendants, in that Mr. Donnell quite clearly, after getting the recommendation about taking the pill, requested a second opinion from another doctor and possible transfer due to these conflicting plans from the hospital's on treatment course. That's what's directly.
Can I stop you there? Once
Sure.
that request for a second opinion is made, what is the hospital policy and procedure?
Sure. And so the hospital policy and procedure in place, and what the evidence has revealed is that Dr. Nolte was required to enter an order. He did not do that. That being said, what he did document was obtaining a second opinion. In his note, I was reading from the initial note just now, Your Honor, was one of the other healthcare providers. Dr. Nolte's own note states, "Patient wanted a second opinion, so we discussed with Dr. King. He was of the opinion of the same opinion that this patient was best to have first line therapy, and that's the pill that we've been talking about. We recommend, we reviewed." Now, counsel accuses me of manufacturing a dispute of fact on this "we," and frankly, I don't mind the charge because it admits that there's a genuine dispute of fact on here. The medical records quite clearly documents "we." Miss Kennedy, the advanced practice nurse, unequivocally testified she does not control a course's patient of treatment. She is not the appropriate person to review images or make decisions. I would submit that that's a fact issue that the jury could infer from the medical records that the "we" that is reviewing and recommending was Dr. King. Now, I know the trial court points to the audit trail, but that is again one version of the facts. It is undisputed that Dr. King himself did not go into a portal and go into the patient's medical records to look at images. That does not in any way obviate or, as a matter of law, require a finding that he did not at all look at the images. Again,
Well, let me ask you this, counsel. Let me just cut in. I'm sorry
sure.
to
No, don't
interrupt.
apologize.
But What evidence, other than Dr. King's name appearing in note number two, suggests he had anything to do with the client? And I want you to also address the fact that the policy and procedure isn't followed, and by a the formality of an order for a
Sure.
second opinion. Can you tie those two together for me and tell me what evidence you have?
Your Honor, again, what evidence we have is the patient's testimony that is in line with the medical records that he did indeed ask for a second opinion from a second doctor. We do have his testimony that Dr. Nolte came in and said, yes, the second opinion doctor agrees with me. And we do have Dr. Nolte's notes where he says, we and we. What other evidence I have? I have testimony and medical records, and that is the extent of it. It is, I believe, Your Honor, still an issue for the best left for the jury as to whether or not he in fact reviewed. And he's going to say that he doesn't remember. But to be clear, it's not that his testimony is I didn't provide a second opinion here. It was I don't remember.
Well,
That was.
any involvement was somewhat limited based upon the facts, so that's somewhat understandable. But what I'm sort of harking on now is the procedure, and
Yes.
it's there's supposed to be some formal order
Sure.
with regard to the second opinion, and I think that's lacking here. I'm just wondering how that affects all things that would have come after the formal order.
I understand, Your Honor.
Formal
That,
order,
I
sorry.
mean, it's certainly undisputed that he did not do per hospital. I mean, it's undisputed that the plaintiff or the patient asked for a second opinion. It's undisputed that the OSF policy requires that the doctor treating him enter an order. Why is that required? Because it does then require Dr. King, the second opinion, to have a much more, we're not having this conversation because then it's a patient-physician relation. He has to put hands on the patient. He's got to get into the patient records. This case is not that. That is an instance where patient-physician relationship is not disputed. This is a special relationship exception that we're going to. And so that's why I think the policy, respectfully, is I don't want to call it a red herring, but the policy would is not, I guess, dispositive on the issue of whether or not there is a factual issue here, based on the records, based on the testimony, as to whether or not Dr. King was in fact sought out for a second opinion, and whether or not that second opinion, I think it's undisputed, absolutely changed this patient's care. It affected his care. He heard then he didn't go to a fourth hospital. The patient got another doctor's opinion, and mind you, again, it's not disputed that Dr. King had performed hundreds of these procedures, and Dr. Nolte had performed none. So I think the jury could infer from all of this that, of course, Dr. Nolte, who was fumbling through the best practice advisories and a very young, new doctor who's not performed that procedure, went to the on-call doctor for him to consult with, Dr. King, and said, Dr. King, this is the facts that I have in front of my case. Here's the imaging that I'm looking at. He's being told that he needs this surgical procedure. Do you agree? And it comes back and he documents that Dr. King was of the same opinion. The doctor recommended the same thing. So this patient's care was absolutely impacted by the role that Dr. Nolte claims that Dr. King played. It is, I believe, the very definition of a question of fact here for the jury. Now, they may very well side with everything that defense counsel points to. There was no order. He's not in the audit trail. He doesn't remember this. If it were more of a formal thing, he would expect X, Y, and Z. But those are all, I think, factual issues. Now, defense claims, again, that's their version, that he was not seeking out a consultation, but a curbside consult. And again, what's absent from the record, among other things.
Excuse me, counsel, but that's really what we have here, is it not? An informal conversation by Dr. Nolte with Dr. King, based on all this, the facts that you talked about and your answer to Justice Kavanaugh's question. There really was no participation in the patient's treatment here, and that is what distinguishes this case from the three that you relied on, Bovara, Slanger, and Blogden, right? I mean, Slanger, the ER doc there, signed off on the patient's care, that is, the discharge by the nurse practitioner. Blogden, the doctor who consulted with the plaintiff's doctor, was the on-call physician and reviewed plaintiff's tests, collaborated with the plaintiff's doctor regarding hospitalization or not. We don't have any of that here. And so I'm
I would respectfully disagree to that point. We do have.
wonder how these, all right, so why don't
Sure.
you respond? I don't know how these cases then would help us with the case before us because of the distinguishing features and facts.
Sure, I appreciate that, Your Honor. And in pointing to Slanger, I would point out that we do have an on-call physician here. And I pointed to citation in the record that was produced by OSF. That was Dr. King's role. We do have evidence that he reviewed the patient's images. Again, Dr. Nolte says we reviewed the images.
Well, let me interrupt for one second. I don't know if we should really focus so much on the semantics because we know that sometimes people, instead of I, use we. I mean, so I don't know that we can put all of our stock in the fact that the word we was, was used.
I'm saying that the stock that we put in it is that you have, that is a question of fact. You cannot infer or say as a matter of law that that we means the royal we, and Dr. Nolte must have been talking about himself. No, Dr. Nolte did what the patient asked. Dr. Nolte documented that the consulting physician, the on-call consulting physician, did review and did collaborate in the extent that he recommended and agreed with the same course of plan, which left the plaintiff with the permanent harm that he suffered there. I would submit that the semantics there point to why this is a fact issue and not an informal consult. Again, curbside consult or informal consult are nowhere mentioned in the medical records. What's mentioned is a second opinion. What is documented is a second opinion doctor who reviews medical records or sorry, imaging, reviews imaging, and is agrees and is of the same opinion that the patient's supposed to have a pill. I think that respectfully, these are the very essence of questions that a jury, and very well, a jury might think like you and say, well, I think Dr. Nolte, we're, the plaintiff's making semantics out of the we. And I think the we, he must have messed up. He must have been referring to himself or maybe somebody else. I don't think it was Dr. King. I think Dr. King seemed credible. And I think that he, he says he didn't look at the records. I know that the medical records say that we reviewed the images. And again, the semantics of the we following a patient requesting a second opinion and the doctor documenting that doctor's name, Dr. King, I think that we, again, is there might be a jury member who says, Your Honor, I disagree. I think that we means that Dr. King absolutely was consulted on this case by Dr. Nolte, who did not have that experience, who went to a guy who had experience and asked him what he thought. So I don't
Are
think
we not
that.
constrained? I know I'm interrupting. Are we not constrained by the hospital protocol not being followed here with regard to a second opinion?
Not
Why
at all.
not?
Not at all.
Why not?
Because I think that that policy then obviates the issue. The policy itself, if it's followed, there's a strict patient-physician relationship on there is no argument about implications that the court has to infer about a special relationship. Now, what we take from Reynolds is that the court will imply or take implications from both the patient consenting to it, right, as well as the involvement of the physicians in the patient's care, whether it affected the care, whether he was actually consulted. And on that point, I think, again, all of the cases are very fact intensive. I think you do bring a point that none of these two are really unique or are the same. But I think the blend of what you can take from Slanger, as you mentioned, or what we can take from Blagden, that says that we can't ignore what, what actually, I forget the line when they're talking about public policy. But switching again to Bavara, Bavara was the treating physician saying, hey, consulting physician, do you think that this procedure is possible? And and the consulting physician says, no, I thought he was asking about whether it was feasible. That equivocal, muddied testimony was very crucial there, and communication there was crucial. And because of that equivocal testimony back and forth, the court said, listen, I can't find this as a matter of law. This is like that case in where I respectfully don't think the trial court can say that it was an informal consult There's certainly evidence that it was an informal counsel, but there's also evidence that it was a second opinion. Just as there's evidence that he didn't review or go into the audit records, but there's also evidence that the Dr. Nolte says that he reviewed images. We have competing stories, I think. And I think when we have competing stories based on the record, based on the testimony, I think the case law says that that equivocal nature means that a jury should infer and that this should be left for the jury.
Counsel, if I may, in page 8 of your brief, you say, like Slanger, Dr. King is documented to have signed off on the medical plan for Mr. Donald.
Yes. Yes.
What document are you referring to where Dr. King signed off?
Sure. In the signed off portion of it is from Dr. Nolte's medical record. Again,
it's not something Dr. King did, even though you've stated Dr. King is to have documented the sign-off. It's something Dr. Nolte in the note that we've been discussing. I just want to make sure I didn't miss something else.
No, you did not miss it, and you hit the note on the head. It's what I'm borrowing is the corollary from Slanger that he was, one, we have documented that he was the on-call physician, and that it signed off on. I'm using the colloquial phrase. What I mean there is that he agreed with the plan. And we do have documentation that Dr. King agreed with Dr. Nolte's take a pill recommendation. And so based on that, I do think it is a fact issue about whether or not he signed off. Now, again, he didn't sign a medical record, but there's no dispute that he did not sign off on a medical record. He did not himself go into the patient's medical record. But what is documented is him signing off and agreeing on Dr. Nolte's opinion, which then was relayed back to this patient and relied on by this patient. I would say that in this case, the testimony is anything but unrebutted. It's certainly not clear and free from doubt. I believe the summary judgment standard is a drastic one. And if there are reasonable persons who can draw divergent inferences based on these records, based on what they testify, based on the semantics of we, I believe it is improper to find as a matter of law, as the trial court did here. I will reserve my 5 minutes. I don't know where I am. It says 11:21, and I think we started on time. So I think I'm running up to my 20-minute moment.
There's 3 minutes remaining on the clock.
So if there are any other questions that the panel has, I can reserve my 5 minutes. I think that's pursuant to rule that I have that 5 minutes. But
you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Okay. Well, then I think I've said what I came to say. I really appreciate everyone's time. Thank you for your astute questions.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Chaddock.
Good morning, Your Honor. I want to start with what plaintiff seems to hinge his entire argument on, which is this idea of we and what it means. My first and initial point was going to be that exactly what the justice already said, is that Dr. Nolte was using we in the royal we sense, that he was using it collectively. But as I was preparing for this argument this weekend, I came to two alarming conclusions. One, the discharge summary upon which the plaintiff relies for much of his argument is not a part of the record on appeal. So to the extent that the court relies on this information about we, I would ask the court allow me as the defense to supplement the record to include the discharge note on the record on appeal. I of course have it up and I can share my screen. I don't know if that's something that the appellate court would allow, but I do want to point out that the second alarming thing I found about this discharge note as I was preparing this weekend is that plaintiff fundamentally misrepresents the discharge note. On page 4 of his appellate brief, his first brief, he has two screenshots of notes from the discharge order. If you view them in the order that he has them posted, maybe there could be some inference that Dr. King looked at some sort of testing or records. Unfortunately, he has cited them out of order. He has them flip-flopped. The real order is that his second screenshot should be first. And so why is that important? Well, it's important because Dr. Nolte's discharge note goes linearly. It goes in a timeline format. His discharge summary and history starts with Aladdin Donald is a 47-year-old Caucasian male with a history of a recent rotator cuff repair with Dr. Joseph. He states he noted swelling and then went to Gibson Hospital. IV filter insertion by Dr. Jesse Valley on February 1, 2018. He was transferred for consideration of DVT lysis. And here's where it gets important. We reviewed the images and felt that he was most appropriate for first-line therapy, Xarelto, for minimum of 3 months of treatment. That week comes before there's any reference to Dr. King. Now the next sentence says the patient wanted a second opinion, so we also discussed with Dr. King. So I think that kind of rules out any suggestion that this we who reviewed the images was Dr. King. That note about reviewing the images and determining the appropriate treatment course, in fact, came before reference of the second opinion, before reference of Dr. King being involved in the care. So whatever we, Dr. Nolte, was using, whether it was he and his nurse practitioner, or whether it was the rural use of we, it clearly wasn't Dr. King. So that usage of the discharge note, it is just a bit misleading. I do want then to kind of look at the facts of the case from a 30,000 foot perspective. The plaintiff was transferred to OSF by Dr. Van Lee from the outside hospital. The patient was transferred for consideration of thrombolysis for a DVT. And the co-defendant, Dr. Nolte, was the attending and admitting physician for the patient when he was transferred. Dr. King played no role of any kind in the transfer of this patient. When the patient gets to OSF St. Francis, Dr. Nolte and his service, the vascular surgery service, did all of the workup. They did the history and physical, they did the physical examinations, they ordered the tests, the labs, etc. Dr. King played no role in any of that. Dr. Nolte, based upon the history, the physical exam, the labs, the testing, etc., he reached the conclusion that a medical management through medication was more appropriate than thrombolysis. He's made this decision before he ever talks to Dr. King. He has already decided on the course of treatment and care. He takes that course of treatment to the patient, and the patient says, well, Dr. Van Lee, the other hospital, said I needed lysis. I want a second opinion, okay? Again, up to this point, no interaction with Dr. King of any kind. So then, after the patient requests a quote-unquote second opinion, apparently, Dr. Nolte had some interaction with Dr. King. I think it's important to note that Dr. Nolte doesn't remember this interaction, or if it even occurred. Dr. King doesn't remember this interaction, or if it even occurred. And APN Kennedy, Dr. Nolte's advanced practice nurse, doesn't remember if this conversation actually occurred or what happened. So no medical provider has any memory of this conversation or can even say it happened. So the trial court did give deference to the facts to the plaintiff in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, in that the trial court assumed that a conversation happened because none of the doctors can even say that that conversation happened. So then we get to this discharge note, which again, plaintiff used out of order. And after the paragraph that talks about we reviewed the images and felt the most appropriate line of therapy, then they come to the only time Dr. King's name is seen in the chart. The patient wanted a second opinion, so we also discussed with Dr. King. He was of the same opinion that this patient was best to have the first line of therapy. Audit trail proves Dr. King never got into this chart. He never looked at any tests. He never looked at any lab results. He didn't look at the history and physical. He didn't look at the records from the prior hospital. The audit trail proves all of that. And the plaintiff in his deposition agreed with me that he had never seen Dr. King. He never spoke to Dr. King. Dr. King never came into his room to provide some sort of examination discussion with this patient. So that leads us to the idea of, was this a formal consultation? Was it a formal second opinion? I know Dr. Nolte called it a second opinion or the nurse called it, the patient wanted a second opinion. But simply because the nurse or Dr. Nolte might have called it a second opinion doesn't mean that it was a true second opinion. As the court's already discussed, OSF has very formal rules about consultations. If Dr. Nolte wanted a formal consultation with Dr. King, he just had to put the order in. And once the order is put in, that triggers a whole ramification of processes. Dr. King would send his nurse practitioner to see the patient. They would review the prior medical records, the history and physical, and all of the medical records from the admitting physician, Dr. Nolte. Then Dr. King would come and examine the patient, and then they would enter a consult. None of that happened here in this case. There was no formal second opinion. And to the extent that you want to say, was there an informal second opinion? I don't think so, really, either. Because all Dr. King apparently did from the records is to say, no, I think you've got the right course of care. So I think all of the cases in this case, it's a rare time that I'm before the appellate court when I can say I think all the cases support me. And the reason I think that is the cases that find that there's no physician-patient relationship support Dr. King in this case. And the cases that do find a physician-patient relationship, that the doctors in those cases had so much more involvement in the care. There were a lot of affirmative actions that led to that physician being deemed to have a physician-patient relationship. I think it's important to talk about the very base definitions of the physician-patient relationship. A physician duty arises only when a physician-patient relationship has been expressly established or there is a special relationship. The special relationship cases have been in the context of like pathology or radiology, where pathology is taken out of the patient, the pathologist never sees the patient, but the pathology goes to the pathologist for review and interpretation. Or there's imaging done of the chest, the radiologist reads the chest X-ray but never sees the patient. That's the special relationship context. And the case law, the Lenihan case in particular, says that for a physician patient relationship to exist, the physician must take some affirmative action to participate in the care of the patient. That is entirely and totally absent here. The cases, when you view them as a whole, look to things like ordering tests, reviewing tests, interpreting lab results, interpreting imaging results, or having direct control over the supervision of the care. None of that occurred here, right? Dr. King had no supervisory control over Dr. Nolte. Dr. Nolte didn't have to do anything Dr. King said. Dr. King didn't look at any tests, lab results, images. He didn't order any tests, lab results, or images. He didn't order any medications. He didn't order any particular line of treatment. So all of the things that the courts have traditionally looked at to see if a physician-patient relationship exists are entirely absent in this case. I think the Reynolds case is exactly on point. The Reynolds case is where a two-year-old came into the emergency department after a fall from a couch. The ED physician involved the pediatrician, and the pediatrician then called at 2 a.m. a neurosurgeon and said, look, we've got this two-year-old that fell off the couch. Here's the symptoms. Here's the test result. The neurosurgeon in that case did more than Dr. King did in this case and was still found not to have a physician-patient relationship. The neurosurgeon in the Reynolds case listened to the spiel from the pediatrician who was calling at 2 a.m. And instead of just saying, no, I agree with your treatment, he recommended a whole new line of investigation. Specifically, he recommended a spinal tap. After recommending the spinal tap during that 2 a.m. phone call, the neurosurgeon had no further contact with the patient. And in that case, Reynolds said merely recommending the spinal tap while taking the phone call is not enough to create a physician-patient relationship. Here, Dr. King didn't even do that. He didn't recommend some other course of treatment that wasn't already anticipated or expected by the treating physician. Also, I think it's important to note that in the Reynolds case, the pediatrician had left a note to consult with Dr. Fulbright, the neurosurgeon, the next morning. But because of some sort of clerical error, that did not occur, right? That's kind of analogous to the argument here that, well, if only he would have entered an official order, if Dr. Nolte would have entered that order for consultation, then Dr. King would have been able to consult. Well, but he didn't. He didn't order the formal consultation, and so Dr. King wasn't able to consult in the normal manner. Same thing happened in Reynolds. the pediatrician overnight wrote an order for a neurosurgeon to consult in the morning, but that never got conveyed to the neurosurgeon, and that can't be held against the neurosurgeon. Just like Dr. Nolte not going through the appropriate processes cannot be held against Dr. King in this case. The Weiss versus Rush case, I think, is also hugely helpful. In that case, the patient came into the emergency department and the ED physician contacted the on-call psychiatrist to arrange follow-up care for the next day. The ED physician discussed with the psychiatrist the presentation, discussed that the patient had refused an admission and wanted to get the patient in to see the psychiatrist. Merely taking the phone call and listening and or agreeing to the plan did not cause the psychiatrist in Weiss versus Rush to be deemed to have a physician-patient relationship. I'm going to skip ahead because I think it gets repetitive. I want to skip to a couple of the plaintiff's cases, the so-called plaintiff's cases, because I think they're pretty helpful to me, honestly. The Mackey case, I think, was cited by the plaintiff. That's a case where the ED physician paged the urologist after identifying a kidney stone. In that case, the ED physician physically needed a doctor of a different specialty. You couldn't treat the kidney stone, right? That's not what we have here. Dr. Nolte could do the lysis if he decided to do the lysis, and he could prescribe the medication. He didn't need Dr. King to do either one of those things. In Mackey, that ED physician needed the urologist. The court also noted in Mackey that the urologist had a contractual obligation and was compensated for his consultations. There's no evidence in this record that Dr. King had any kind of contractual obligation or that he was compensated for his consultations. In fact, there's no evidence that Sierra ever billed for this patient, right? Dr. King did not bill for this patient. Also, in the Mackey case, the urologist was deemed to have a physician-patient relationship because he ordered a medication. He ordered Flomax. Again, Dr. King made no orders of any kind, certainly didn't order a medication, and didn't prescribe any particular treatment course. So again, even though the Mackey case found that there was no physician-patient relationship, I think it completely supports my case. And that is to say that where there's evidence of active participation, like prescription of medication, or having a contractual obligation, then there might be a physician-patient relationship. Those things are entirely absent from this case. The Slinger case, again, I think favors me. In Slinger, a nurse practitioner saw the patient in the emergency department. The doctor, Dr. Collins, in that case, was an ED physician. The patient could not be discharged from the ED without the ED physician reviewing the history and physical, the exam results, the labs, and agreeing with the nurse practitioner's view of the case. The patient could not be discharged without the ED physician signing off. That's not the case here. Dr. King had no supervisory authority over Dr. Nolte. Nolte could treat this patient in any way he wanted to. So Slinger, again, I think supports me. Bovera, I think, is another good one that supports me. In Bovera, the cardiologist asked two of his interventional cardiology partners to review an angiogram to determine whether or not angioplasty would be appropriate. The case made absolutely clear that was the regular routine and procedure. The cardiologist was not qualified to read the angiograms, so the two interventional cardiologists read the angiograms and offered an opinion on whether angioplasty was appropriate. Again, there was no procedure in place here that suggested that Dr. King had to take consults from Dr. Nolte, or that he was contractually obligated to do so, or that he was compensated to do so. And again, he didn't review anything like an angiogram. Dr. King didn't. Dr. King didn't look at any of it. So for that reason, I think Bovera supports me. And then the last case, because I know I'm getting repetitive and I apologize, but the last case that I'll touch on because I think it's supportive is the Blagden case. Again, Blagden's a case where an ED physician called the on-call primary care physician. The primary care physician was called because he could admit patients and the ED physician couldn't. Okay, so the primary care physician who was on call and was called in that case and found to have a physician-patient relationship was the one that had the final say on whether the patient could be admitted. He had the final authority on whether the patient was admitted. Again, Dr. King had no such authority over Dr. Nolte, over this patient's treatment course, or anything like that. So I do think that the case law is entirely favorable to the defendant. And finally, the Reynolds and the Reynolds court and the Cunningham court noted what a chilling effect it will have on doctors and patients if we say taking a phone call or bumping into someone in the hallway exposes a doctor to liability. It will have a stifling effect on communication amongst physicians. It will have a stifling effect on the exchange of information and medical knowledge. And that's bad for the physicians, and that's bad for the public, bad for the patients. So for all of those reasons, we think that there are no facts that suggest that a physician-patient relationship should be imputed upon Dr. King when he had no involvement of any kind. He had no affirmative action or involvement in the care, the treatment, etc. And again, I want to go back to the discharge summary because I'm so concerned how it was used out of order in the appellate brief. I would urge that the discharge summary should not be relied upon by the appellate court for their decision. But if you determine that it's appropriate to rely on it, I would very much like to supplement the record with that so you can read it in full and in the correct order, not out of order. So for all of those reasons, unless you have any questions for me, judges, I have nothing further.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. All right. The appellant has 5 minutes in rebuttal, but if I could, I would just prompt you, perhaps you could address the use of the word we and the timing, the involvement of Dr. King.
Your Honor, are you addressing that question to me?
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, and yep. I just thought I'd prompt you on this one question that was brought up early in Attorney Chaddock's argument with the use of the word we and the timing with Dr. King's involvement.
Again, all Mr. Chaddock is doing is presenting a version of facts that is favorable to his client. What he did not say was that screenshot was not from the discharge note. The discharge note was the last note that Dr. Nolte prepared, and the discharge note was made after the second opinion was garnered. So his use of the word we through his discharge summary is, as counsel says, he says he's writing it linearly. That's not testimony that was elicited. But even if, again, with the order of it is not relevant. The order is that they were both in the discharge note. And I screenshotted also the interdisciplinary note, which came before that. The course of care here was he came into Dr. Nolte's care. Dr. Nolte saw him, said, "Get, take a pill." Patient says to interdisciplinary team, "I want a second opinion." That is documented. That second opinion, Dr. Nolte was notified. That's also in the record. Dr. Nolte was notified. And so he prepares a discharge note after seeing the patient, after seeking the second opinion, and discharging the patient. He's writing out an entire note about the course of care of Aladdin from his presentment through his discharge. So his use of the word we, again, is a fact question, and the order does not matter. The use of the word we alone on the we reviewed the images, we recommend, Dr. King is of the same opinion. Again, it's all there. They're all facts that can be drawn in the light. I believe a jury could draw those lights in the favorable to the plaintiff. The affirmative act, again, none of these cases the defense counsel is talking about, is there any documentation of a second opinion as documented in the record? So none of those cases say anything similar to the fact pattern here, where Dr. Nolte undisputably documented a second opinion sought, obtained, and relayed to the patient by Dr. King. None of those cases say anything about it. In fact, in Reynolds, the pediatrician did not specifically ask the neurosurgeon during that telephone conversation, and there was no documented evidence whatsoever that there was a second opinion requested, right? All of these cases are about, was it an informal bump in the hallway? By the way, this was not a bumping in the hallway informal meeting. This was a second opinion that was requested by a patient and was documented by the treating physician, Dr. Nolte, of obtaining that second opinion. So it wasn't the informal conversations that it, where Reynolds, and he, by the way, he points to the supervisory role. Again, that has, and the fact that this patient was not seen and did not review records. In Bovera, in fact, the patient, as we talked about, the patient was never seen by the interventional cardiologists, never had any hands on them. And there, what was central to the case was whether a jury could find that the consulting physician knew or should have known that the medical opinion about the plaintiff's course of treatment or care was likely to be passed on by the patient to the treating physician, and would be crucial to that patient. Of note there, the consulting physician also never reviewed any of the patient's medical records and had any contact with the patient. But central to the finding of a question of fact in that case was this equivocal, muddy disconnect between the conversations between the treating and the consulting physician. We have that here. We have a disconnect. We have equivocal testimony on this point. And I'll point to just the last little point that counsel had mentioned about contractual obligation. Again, OSF's document production, and I cited to that in my brief, I think it's C-642, shows that he was the only guy on call. And again, it's undisputed that Dr. Nolte was not yet board certified, had not likely performed the procedure before. And his own testimony, when asked, was why were you consulting Dr. King? Dr. King and his group also performed thrombolytic procedures, and I wanted Dr. King and his group to review it and to see if they thought they would want to perform that procedure. And I have a cite of that on C603. So what we have here are two different versions of the facts. We have what summary judgment should not be granted on. When you have two different sets of facts, one supplanted from the records and the inferences therefrom and the implications that those records have, and the other from the, I don't know, I don't remember, this feels like a curbside informal opinion. I mean, that's the case.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Your time is up. Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement. Now is in recess.